Recently, the author of The Tiger's Wife. Taya, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I must confess that Survivor's Eye of the Tiger was in my head on the way over here the entire time, and I have you to blame for that.
Thank you. I keep hearing it on radios now, and like whenever I do, I start to get embarrassed. I don't know
really?
Why.
You get embarrassed?
Yeah.
You get shamed?
I don't know why, because I get really, you know, I get really into it, and I'm like, it's kind of pertinent now, and then I get embarrassed about myself.
Do you get sick of tigers now that you have dwelt on them quite heavily and you have to constantly talk about them?
You know, I don't think I do. I think that it's just getting more and more entrenched into what I do every day.
Yeah.
You know, like every email I send has a tiger picture attached to it that's like pertinent to the conversation.
Wow.
I'm sure that at some moment like a big break will come and I would be like, I never want to see any feline again, and we'll like kick cats as I go down the street. Not really. But
violence is welcome on this program, even hypothetical violence. So you have to become a tiger expert, I presume. have you been reading up on cats and the like? Or?
I studied tigers a little bit,
yeah.
You know, for the writing of the book, and went and sat and watched them in zoos a lot. And I'm a total National Geographic nerd anyway,
yeah.
So it came naturally.
Oh, let's talk about nerddom. National Geographic nerddom.
Yay.
How much do you have to know about tigers to write about them? Or do they sort of exist within the wonderful theater of the mind? What's up?
I'm a big believer in the theater of the mind, especially when you're dealing with fiction. I mean, there's only so much you can know, and then there's only so much you can of what you know that you can transmit before it begins to be clinical.
Yeah.
So I think that research, while it helps, can sometimes really destroy you.
Yeah.
And I was very happy to, you know, take a little bit of what I knew and run with that and sort of let a thousand imaginations bloom about tigers. And,
wow. So you've learned this fairly early on. A lot of writers have to wait decades before they realize sometimes that, you know, maybe I shouldn't read every single book on a subject, but you've managed to actually avoid that from the get-go. To what do you attribute this
laziness.
Extra wisdom? Laziness? Oh, I see. The practical temperament concerns.
Yes. I think that there's, you know, I think that I'm always terrified of, I think a lot of students that I've had at Cornell have been terrified of not making their intentions known in their writing,
yeah.
Or not having something clear in the writing. I've always been terrified of the exact opposite. I've always been afraid of letting too much be known too quickly, or
yeah.
Hitting the reader over the head with something, because I know that that used to be one of my flaws. So I'm so overly cautious about it that I think that it sometimes cripples me. I'm sure that there are things that I could research a little bit more heavily when I write about them, but
being too explicit about stuff, like such as?
I don't know. I think that when, you know, such as a particular kind of character interaction or...
Such as?
Well, actually, I'm thinking of my short story here. I know that it's not... For some reason, I can't think of an example from the book. But my short story, The Laugh, there's
yeah.
this tension between the two main characters. One is the husband of a recently deceased woman, and the other is his best friend, but also someone who was interested in the deceased wife. And I was terrified of letting this out, you know, too quickly and, you know, immediately and explicitly at the beginning of the story, because it would totally break the tension. And so in an early, you know, in the first like five drafts of the story, it wasn't clear at all. People were like, why is this happening? And I was like, well, he likes her, you know, and then
yeah.
and then it, or used to, you know, now she's dead. But so for me, it's always this holding back and then trying to ease into being okay with the information being there.
Is this one of the chief concerns when you're going through this endless rewriting and endless revising, to just find that tonal balance that really strikes what the reader needs to know and what the reader needs to infer?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Because I think that, and I mean, that's one of the great endeavors of the short story, this negotiation between the reader and the writer and how that information is being transferred and how you can transfer information in a way where the reader knows, like, they have the implication is already there, and all you have to do is trigger it with that one word for the reader's neural pathways to open up in that particular direction. And I mean, it's so much fun. And
you sound like a drug dealer. Dopamine hits or something.
Well, I do use a lot of caffeine. No, but it is, you know, as a reader, I enjoy seeing how that happens.
Yeah.
You know, how I came to the same conclusion as another reader. And that was one of the great exercises of workshop. Like, how did you get to this place with this story and I got to a completely different place? Or how do we arrive at the same place? Where was the information that led us both there? I love that as a reader, so I enjoy it as a writer as well.
But if you're constantly revising to get that precision, how do you keep yourself in surprise? Because that, of course, is very important to maintain the life of a story.
Oh, that sort of just comes normally because I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah. The big thing that nobody really understands, that writers really don't know what they're doing often. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it's just you know, you stumble into things, and you'll be 75% of the way through something, and suddenly it's like, oh, I changed my mind. This is gonna happen because it feels more normal, you know, more natural. Then you have to backtrack and shift everything.
Almost knock things over.
I'm okay.
If we knock
here,
something over, it will make this conversation 300% better.
That's awesome.
It's already going very well. I want to actually talk. I mean, we're talking about that mode of precision. We're talking about what you don't know and what is known on the page. And this leads me to ask you about some of your metaphors. I'll refer to a few in The Tiger's Wife. You have, of course, this musician who becomes a butcher. You have the marriage episode whereby one sister is swapped for another. You have Darissa the bear, whose tremendous success as a hunter was derived from his ability to actually turn into a bear. I mention all this because it's fascinating to me how much of The Tiger's Wife involves this X to Y, but not these sort of great gradients in between. And I'm wondering if you know, to what degree this end result in these three cases I mentioned, there's many more throughout the book, has much to do with what we're talking about not knowing what you're doing, but trying to find something that just is absolutely alive and absolutely explicit so that you do know what you're doing, or you have some illusion that you know what you're doing, and the reader can therefore share in the pleasure.
I think that those are great examples. I didn't even think of those. But yeah, I think that, you know, you sort of, I keep saying you, but I can only speak for myself.
Yeah,
I'm so
sorry.
We
could talk in first person plural if you like.
I'd like that. We.
Yeah.
I found in writing this that the biggest challenge for me was giving the individual stories and the individual threads of the stories enough time and enough room to become whatever it was that they were supposed to be. Not that there's some great story god out there who's like, you must find your way to the right.
There is,
or that
no
there
secret
is a right.
For
yes,
the literary
exactly,
world.
Exactly.
The secret, I'll tell you the secret.
Tune in. Yeah. The thing about that is, you know, you arrive at the wrong formula so often. And in this book, I would arrive at the wrong formula quite often. And huge chunks of the story would rest on these wrong formulas. And I would go on knowing that it was the wrong formula and say, when the right thing comes to me, I'll go back. And whatever way I need to change it, I'll change it. But I can't stall at this wrong formula. A really good example of that is the elephant scene with the grandfather, which for a long time, you know, I wrote the book and realized a lot of this, a lot of the theme in it was about earning a story, earning the right to be told a story, what you do with that story, the relationship between the storyteller and the story receiver, and realized that the conditions under which the grandfather tells Natalia about the deathless man in the first episode were just total garbage. I mean, they're sitting in the original draft, they're sitting at a table, and he just starts to tell her the story. I think the trigger is like seeds. They're talking about seeds, and these seeds lead to a conversation about food, and then food leads to that porridge in the opening of that scene. And it was just inane. It was just horrible. And I knew it. You know, I knew that I kept going on. But the thing is that at that moment, I needed something to jump over that hump of, I really don't know what to do with the section here, but the section after it, I'm really excited about. And that happens often, I think, in writing a big project. So I end up going to the Syracuse Zoo on some none particular day when I was feeling low about the writing, and they had an elephant petting. And they had brought the elephant out, and the elephant was, like, swarming with kids. There were, like, 10 kids hanging on it. You know, I elbowed a bunch of kids out of the way and, like, got in there to pet the elephant because, hey, you know, how often does that happen? And that whole scene with the elephant in the street and the fact that they had to have rifted, it just happened in, like, 10 seconds or less while I was standing there with that elephant. That, for me, can't happen unless the time is given so that your brain can sit with this idea of what happens now, really, what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And so I think that you stumble into that, and if you just give yourself time and you walk into it. Was that at all an answer?
Oh, no, that's totally an answer. And in fact, actually, it leads me to ask you about something I have observed in this book. I mean, you're talking about getting the world of this sort of quasi-Balkans, quasi-real, quasi-fictional, or perhaps just purely fictional world. You're talking about using your vantage point in Syracuse to get something that has verisimilitude. Going to the Syracuse Zoo to translate that into a place thousands of miles away. It also leads me to ask you about one early moment in the book where you have Natalia sharing earbuds on the Walkman with this strapping young guy. And I read this thing, you know, that sounds a lot like what I see with a lot of these young people who are taking these iPods and exchanging the earbuds. It seems to me that based off of this and what you've just said, that you need to have some present-day experiential incident with which to use for fiction. So how does this work for you? Has this happened quite a lot with Tiger's Wife and also the short story and all that?
I think that you need to have... I think it's a weird combination. Yeah. There does have to be something in your life at that moment that connects you to some aspect of the story in a very immediate way. The ways that can happen are surprising and never the same, even for different parts of the story. And you can extrapolate things from your own life and also the lives of other people, which is why the family members and friends of writers, I think, as writers begin to use more and more of their stuff, talk to their the writer and their family less and less. You know?
Yeah.
You become this outcast. Like, don't tell her anything. It's
suddenly
end
you
up
have
in
new
book.
Friends and new acquaintances
exactly.
with which to squeeze out. Squeeze out those stories. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, but and I think that, there has to be some connection to your life. It has to resonate with some emotional truth in you. And that's for me, that has ended up being the truth of write what you know.
Yeah.
It's write what you're concerned with, feeling, experiencing, hateful of at that moment. And, you know, the fiction then will blend with whatever reality is there. And it'll come out as fiction, but it'll come out as earnest fiction. I don't know how to explain
that. No, that totally makes sense. It sounds to me like what we're talking about are trigger points. And this leads me to ask you about something I just have to. I'm a big Emir Costa Rica fan. And I have to say, the first part of Underground, where you have the boy with the parrot on his shoulder, and then you have the bombing of the zoo in Belgrade, with the tiger running around the cage, with everybody, all the animals flocking off like that. Mm-hmm. I said to myself, that sounds a little, you know, I mean, I actually thought about this after I read your book, but then I was thinking about, oh, I'm going to talk with her, and then all of a sudden it just popped into my head. Wait a minute, that's very close to Underground. I also know, based off of reading a Trip McGrath profile, that you had an early life of Disney films. And I'm wondering how much, say, films along these lines have formed these trigger points to creating fiction like this. And also, what Costa Rica, I mean, how familiar are you with his movies?
I'm pretty familiar. I'm not, you know, I'm not as familiar as I should be. I know Underground.
It comes out.
Yes, I know. I mean, like, that's one of those things. Where, and I remember... being a child, I didn't see the zoo scene until more recently. I didn't see the whole film until more recently, but when I was watching the film, I had these flashbacks to my childhood and seeing different scenes of that film when my parents were watching it, and I'd like flip through the room, you know, and you'd be like, oh, and like walk. And like the soundtrack to Underground is like one of the great, you know,
all of the soundtracks are great. Yeah, Black Cat, White Cat has a great soundtrack too. Has this sort of like techno gypsy thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it's dated now, but I still like the.
No,
we're
still into that. It's not so dated over there. but I think that you know, Kusturica is a legend. That particular moment in history is a favorite moment because it's so weird and so particular to Belgrade, and I think that people from the region have a tendency to respond really emotionally to it. And everybody who grew up in Belgrade went to that zoo. I mean, it's like a central point of the city, not just because it's like where you take your kids to see some stuff that's foreign, but like it's part of the fortress that, you know, defines the city, Kalemegdan Fortress. It's part of, it was a huge, there were these conservation programs that rose up. You know, it's a great pride of the city. And I think that this history of it having been bombed and then the episode of animals fleeing, and like in everybody's account, like different animals flee, you know what I mean? In Kusturica, the tiger dies.
Yes.
He gets, you know, he gets a rock in the side and it's tragic. And the, you know, the boy flees with the ape.
Yeah.
And, you know, the elephant in the shoes in the window and stuff. But, you know, there's, everybody tells different accounts of, in fiction, but also in their personal accounts. It's like, oh, I saw a leopard, but it turns out that, you know, your great-granddad didn't see a leopard because the leopard didn't escape, whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry, I went off.
Oh, no, rambling is great. But,
I think that, you know, film is a huge influence for me in general. I think that the emotional heights and the emotional lows that you can receive as an audience of a film are very pertinent to fiction, and the ways film deals with the problem of revealing narrative, what you can see, feel, experience, interpret from a film can teach you how to work that into your fiction. And for me, it's very important, especially for dialogue.
Yeah. So dialogue, you get more from films than, say, from observing people in real life? Really?
I think so, yeah. Because,
is it because it's stylized that this will be helpful for you more as a fiction writer?
Or? I think that it's, I mean...
Or you're just a big introvert? Is that what this is?
I am a big introvert.
Yeah.
It's, well, I think that when you... I'm trying to think of a good example, and all I can... Like, I keep thinking about, like, Bogart and Bacall movies.
Yeah.
And those, you
anything
know...
Anything by Howard Hawks.
Yeah, exactly. I think that... The way actors, like good great actors with great dialogue, like a movie will fall apart on bad writing. It's true, and it's been seen in many trilogies. You know, the last movie is not written as well as the first two, and then it falls apart. So what great actors can do?
I know, Nakoi Katsi. I mean, Jesus, talk about destroying the Katsi trilogy. Actually, I like it.
But great actors and what they can do with great dialogue and great story and sort of this understanding that you get from the way two people play off of each other, this doesn't happen in real life. You know, you have to treat fiction as something fabricated, and it is, because if you wrote dialogue, the way dialogue really sounds between two people, people talk past each other all the time.
Yeah.
They don't finish sentences. I don't finish sentences when I haven't finished a single sentence since I started talking. it's this idea of how it can be as natural as possible while still maintaining that it's not natural at all, because the information that you're getting across is necessary information,
sure,
not just between the characters but to the audience.
Yeah.
So that's how dialogue helps me, and I write talking aloud to myself when I write dialogue, and I just write what is being said, and then I go back and retreat it with what's going on.
It's fascinating to me that we're talking about going to the Syracuse Zoo, catching bad trilogies. These are your influences more than books and more than people. So is this largely because, influences when you're dealing with fabulated mechanisms must indeed also be heightened? Or how do you keep that truth going? Because there's a lot of truth in this book, especially like the wails of children who are crying out for candy. There's one section in the book. There's the very lengthy and terrible story of Luca and all that, and the people who are his victims. I mean, you know, there's some very harrowing stuff in this book, and even though there is a sort of fabulist element to it, there's also a very real element to it. So, you know, how do you account for how something fabulous becomes something that is, well, reasonably authentic even within that fabulous realm?
I have no idea, but I'm so glad you feel that way. Oh, thank you. I think that humor does a lot to bridge that gap between a magical treatment of something harrowing and reality. And I know that I've never responded very, very well to stories of tragedy that are told as stories of tragedy. And this may have something to do with my upbringing.
Yeah.
In the Balkans, there's this tendency to treat things that are absolutely horrifying with a great deal of humor, and you laugh about it all the time.
Yeah.
I think that in instances, in literature and film, in even when people are anecdotally telling you something awful that happened to them, as a human being, I'm a lot more likely to bond to the experience if you throw in some sort of joke. I think that's like a life goes on kind of response. I don't know what it is.
So how do you deal with, say, Shoah and Gulag Archipelago in your life? I mean, not a lot of humor in those. But very interesting and harrowing and fascinating. But, you know, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, you joke about it after reading it.
That's I see. Oh, yes, of course. Now I come off as a big, you know, joker in regards to Claude Lanzmann and Sol Sinenstein. Well, I mean, this is interesting to me. So you need to have the humor there before you confront tragedy?
I think you need to find the humor in tragedy. I don't know. I mean, at least I do.
Yeah.
As a human being. And even in situations of minor stress, I have a tendency to respond by cracking really bad jokes, and this sometimes disturbs people and irritates them.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it would
I can
whatever
relate to
gets
this.
You through the day. I think that, and I think that was one of the things that happened in the book, and literature that I really respond to, like Garcia Marquez.
Yeah.
Like Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, which is my, like, fall to your knees before the shrine of this book kind of, you know, literary deity. There's these terrible things that happen, but the way they're presented to you, I think it's all in the presentation. If you give it in this bizarre way, there's an understanding of how horrible it is. There's an understanding of how tragic it is, but there's also an understanding of it somehow being a transcendent experience through which you are learning something about something.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Life, death, yourself, friendship, you know, and I think that those moments in literature have a tendency to be very moving to me, and I think that finding that humorous path towards the real was something that I had to try to do in this book, and I'm so glad that you responded to it.
So, you're saying to me, I think also, that style is really what separates the barren and stark and ultra-serious narrative from something that may have more nuance? Does humor allow something to be presented with more emotional complexity, do you think? And is it there in the style?
It depends. I mean, I don't think that things that are stark and straightforward lack complexity. I think that for myself as a reader, you know, you have an emotional key that opens a particular kind of door, and sometimes certain things just don't hit you the way other things do at different times in your life, and this changes, you know, year to year. I think because of my upbringing, that kind of treatment of serious subject matter is something that I relate to and respond to. I think that, you know, literature that deals straightforwardly with those things. With those things, with things and stuff, with subject matter, with serious subject matter, with tragedy. I think that it, you know, I've read wonderful stuff that I have bonded to emotionally against all odds, you know, that, and if only I could think of an example, that would be important. And I will.
Well, actually, I had not read a single book until I read The Tiger's Wife. I'm not sure if you knew that, but...
I've never read anything. I don't. In fact, I'm actually illiterate. I dictated it.
Oh, you're doing the Steingart stick. Yeah.
For instance, Prayer for the Dying, Stuart Onan's Prayer for the Dying.
Yes.
Which is so dark in every possible way, and.
But it's also funny in the efforts to get around. You've got this circus trying to get around this crazy blockade. And it actually is sort of comic in that sort of Stuart Onan, very dry way. So it's not explicitly stark, but it is interesting as well.
That's true. I think that But I mean, it deals with something that is absolutely horrifying. Oh, yeah. And I remember reading that book and not sleeping. I told Stuart this. He came to Cornell. He was there for a semester. And, I came up to him and with the book and was like, this is one of the best books I ever read. I didn't sleep for 3 nights. And he was like, you know, he gave me this look that was like, I'm so sorry.
He gives everybody that look, I think, in regard.
He's wonderful. Yeah. He's wonderful. He's so great. It was a deeply disturbing experience to me. I think I learned from it as a writer. And I bonded emotionally to that book, despite the fact that it didn't have humor. What is it in it that I bonded emotionally to? Probably death, which is horrible. But for instance, I laugh about it, and, you know, I guess so does Stuart in a way, but
well, death is inherently funny.
Yes, it is.
One of the funniest Fawlty Towers episodes is the Kipper of the Corpse. Some of the funniest books involve death.
It's true, and
that's really the only way to approach it, really.
That's true. You know? That's true. Because if it's something inevitable, then you might as well.
Yeah, I mean, why spend your life worrying about death when it's funny?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
Well, and, speaking of which, I mean, how did you stumble upon the idea of using coffee grounds as a way with which to signify whether you are a deathless man or not?
That's a really good question.
For the dregs of coffee, yeah.
It's actually done in the Balkans. Sorry, I'm like, why do I? That is a good question. Why is that? Your first thought is, man, where did I inadvertently steal that from?
At least you're being honest.
But it turns out, real life, thank God. There's people who live around us in both Serbia and Croatia, you know, and they have these women in their 80s and 90s, and every so often, like, your neighbor will come over and be like, you want to come over, get your coffee red? Like, and literally, that's, you know, the expression. Like, she'll look at your coffee, and you're like, oh, I don't know. It has a tendency, like, in the Balkans, we make Turkish coffee. It's, like, really thick, and, like, all that sediment sinks to the bottom, you know, so it's really accommodating in that regard. We have a tendency to dredge our tea really, really well, so leaves are out of the question.
You watch so much coffee sinking to the bottom over the years, inevitably you're going to develop some astrological solution to this. We could be very well be doing that here if we sit here for, like, the next 10 years. No, but also, like, the parrot who quotes poetry. I mean, you know, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about metaphor, about the precision of metaphor. But there is something that seems sort of mythological about it as well, or in that sort of Balkan mode, and then I'm curious how much you deliberated also over the parrot for that matter.
Parrot. Well, I wanted that poetry in there for some reason, and it had like a larger role in the first draft.
Oh, I see.
And then the parrot just stuck with it. But there's all
and the
these.
Parrot took the poetry away.
The parrot
away.
Just
yeah.
took the poetry away. I think that as for metaphor itself, I don't think that a lot of the ways metaphor and symbol ended up in the book were intentional for me. I think that, you know, I turned around after the fact and was like, okay, here are all these things that are going on. Why?
Yeah.
And then in the rendering of the second draft, tried to tie them in to one another. I think that there is this fascination with the mythology of animals, the mythology of objects, not mythology in like the great capital M sense of the word, but like personal mythology.
Yeah.
I remember living in our apartment in Belgrade, and there was this dog that lived downstairs. It was a Spuds McKenzie. It was an old English bull terrier.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were all these myths that went around in the building about this dog. And it was just, you know, it was an 8-story building with 2 apartments per floor. And everybody had a different story about this dog. And so when it finally vanished, it was like, it killed the woman downstairs, you know. It grew wings. And that's just in like a city building.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that there is this tendency to really make the objects and non-human components of your life signify you in a way that is your own.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like really prevalent in our culture and bled through into the book.
But
somehow,
as with most of your personal mythology, I would argue, it does come down to animals. I want to follow up on this whole National Geographic nerddom that you mentioned at the top. I also want to tie this in with Kipling's The Jungle Book, which we have not discussed. And I also want to discuss this with what I brought up earlier, which was watching a lot of Disney movies as a kid and using this as the basis for, you know, learning English, which made me think of all sorts of possibilities. But I want to ask you about it. I mean, there's a very rosy view that Disney presents. Do you think that by learning English from this source, it kind of created your own rosy view, which you used to write and to speak and all that? And do you think that this is also one of the reasons why animals have also been so prevalent in this book and in your concerns? And also, to add another question on top of that, The Jungle Book was made in a rather sanitized way in 1967 by Disney. So what of all this?
I think that despite my extremely Disneyfied upbringing, which, you know,
it sounds very close to dignified, Disneyfied. That's right.
I'm trying to coin the phrase. I think that I have a very bleak outlook on the world in general, which goes against that.
Yeah.
Even though I grew up with those stories, I was always drawn in more and mystified more and terrified and therefore very seduced by, you know, the Jim Henson version of that, which is the dark, creepy, like, oh my God, what is that kind of mythology as well. What was the question? Jungle Book. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. I threw a bunch at you. We were trying to get at animals, learning English from Disney, Jungle Book, both in its Kipling and its Disney form, as sort of starting points with which to deal with language in your life.
Well, I think that... I'm trying to draw...
No. That's great.
I think that the sort of unifying thread with all these is myth and mythology and the building of mythology and a particular kind of rendering of the same story over and over and over again. This might be coming to me because I've spent like the last 3 days listening to Joseph Campbell, and that's all I've been doing in a kind of slobbering, happy way. But I think that... obviously you form attachments to certain things as a kid. This leads you to either be extremely attached to them as an adult or completely reject them as an adult, or at different phases of your adulthood you may simultaneously reject and embrace them.
Yes.
For me, the way into language was through story, because it was through Disney. And at the time, I think that the biggest concern from my parents, from my family, from my mom and my grandparents, was the aesthetic of those films. And the idea that there was a beginning, middle, and end, a moral to it. And look, it was actually done really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to other things that were going on at the time, not literature, because I was always encouraged to read. But my way into that was always through this rationality of, look at the pattern in this, and look at how beautiful it is. When you do something, you do it right. Like, it was all this, you know. And then the stories in that are all more or less the same story. It's all the hero journey, no matter what. The Jungle Book was one of the first books I read in Serbian, and then again one of the first books I read in English, and I always read it from a non-American standpoint, which didn't address the whole colonialism issue, which I didn't discover until I got to college and started, you know, to grad school.
Same
actually,
here.
And started writing.
It was a shock to learn. Oh my God!
It's like, oh, news to me.
I've been lied to all these years.
I know exactly. Like, we don't like Kipling, do we? Like it was literally one of those moments where I was like, this has nothing to do with colonialism, because one of my first workshops was like a breakdown of the Tiger's Wife and the influences of the Jungle Book on colonialist, you know, imagery in it. And I was like, what? I just read it because it was a children's book. But
that does actually demonstrate the interesting capacity of narrative. It can sneak so much into it that it can actually be quite dangerous.
Yes.
So how do you deal that from the opposite end of the periscope as a writer? You know, the possibility that you may be embedding some, you know, I don't know. I don't think you are, but if Kipling can get away with it, could you get away with it subconsciously?
You know, I think that that's sort of out of your hands.
Yeah.
You have to make your peace with the fact that you've written it with your own intentions in mind. People can interpret it. I'm sure that you could, you know, you could read any book and find a subtext for absolutely anything. And there's people in universities all over the world doing that at this very moment.
They have to keep their jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
They have to.
That's what they, you know, and you know, sometimes those interpretations become the standard mode of thinking about that particular work, and sometimes they don't. And, you know, you hope that the way people read it is the way that you intended to write it, but the truth is that you can't go knocking on everybody's door and going, listen, this is how what you're supposed to think, or and largely because half the time you don't even know what they're supposed to think.
Well, since we're talking about mythology, we haven't really discussed why you chose a fictitious version of the Balkans that doesn't exist on any map. This leads me to ask, if mythology can't be tied, from your point of view, to any specific geographical place, whether it be the real Balkans or, for example, America, which people argue about whether it's a big, vapid wasteland incapable of adopting its own mythology, or whether it actually can contain that from on a personal level. So what are your thoughts on this as a writer? Why did you choose a faux Balkans as opposed to the real thing?
Because that's how Disney would have done it. No.
you need to learn is from Disney. Yeah.
Disney. No, I'm kidding. I think that was one of those clear-cut choices from the very beginning, and one of the few things in the book that I actually didn't have any control over. I didn't want the reality of the situation, of a very charged, very publicly known situation, to get in the way of the story that I wanted to tell. And the story that I wanted to tell was about the aftermath and effects of war on individuals and individual psyche and the creation of that personal mythology, which happens in families, which happens in communities, which happens in whole countries, and happens the whole world over, in more or less, turns out, the same way from culture to culture, with mild variations. You know, getting into the politics of it, getting into the specifics, you begin to lose yourself in that very fact-based reality that we were talking about at the beginning that can sometimes be extremely dangerous. It can just destroy. I mean, are you, in this particular book, the question was, are you writing fiction, or are you going to write about collective history or personal history? And personal history won in this round. Now, there's great books written about collective history that are dead on, you know, from everything from, you know, Greece to Russia, from, you know, 5000 BC to now, and they're wonderful books. For this one, it happened that reality didn't come into it as much as it perhaps could have. But I think that America has a great mythology, and you know, the mythology of immigration and this notion of these tall tales of the westward expansion, and I love those stories. And as you know, as an immigrant kid who was coming over here, all I wanted was, you know, a cowboy hat and I just couldn't wait to get.
But there you've identified what I'm talking about here, the cowboy hat, as opposed to an endless strip of Flintstones-like suburbia with McDonald's and Target and Costco and whatever. I mean,
yes, but I think that there's an underlying. I think that, I mean, America is right now, and unfortunately it appears to be waning, But in a state of financial glut.
Yeah.
And that happens to, at one time or another, every culture and every civilization.
Yes.
And when the balance of that glut is, you know, when that glut strikes balance with its own history, its politics, the way people want to live eventually as it sort of pans out, the mythology comes to the surface. So I think that, you know, as we begin to weed out these things that aren't, that we're finding less and less necessary in the, you know, the suburbia of the of post-50s
yeah.
American society, that, you know, push for freedom, the push for immigration, the push for a better life that isn't just about having everything you want at the exact moment you want it, but of actually working for it, that will return to the surface. And that is about, you know, the way this country came to be. In you know, that does go back to those old myths. And I think yeah. that's still there and is coming to the surface more and more and more as people are fighting for their rights.
So is the next novel dealing with some of what we've just been talking about in relation to America, or?
Actually, no, because I still feel, you know, I'm always going to feel like a nomad and I'm always going to feel like an immigrant, I think.
Yeah,
There's certain things that you're just born into the culture knowing. Pop references, things that happen as you were growing up, as your parents were growing up, and these things mystify me. There are turns of phrase that, you know, Americans use, and I'm like, what does that mean? And then, you know, it just destroys the whole conversation at the dinner table, and then I'll say something like, well, it must come from da-da-da-da-da-da, and then I go off on like a five-minute, you know, like quest for how did this expression arise? And by that point, people are just miserable around me. And so I try not to do it as much as I should. But in that regard, I'm still an immigrant, and I feel like I can't write about America necessarily just yet.
But is that really the immigrant experience, or is that more of a relentless curiosity, almost an autodidactic kind of approach?
I don't know.
You don't know. It just is for you. Yeah.
It just is. Yeah. It just is for me, and I know it is annoying for people around me. I think that it's in part due to the immigrant.
Yeah. Sure.
Status.
This leads me to also ask. I mean, your book has, in a few quarters, received some rather strange and hostile reviews. I mean, I think of this sort of ditz in the New York Observer, who called your book a young adult novel, which was fascinating news to me. I had no idea. There are other people who have gone after you for being a young woman writer and all this, and how dare she win the Orange Prize, etc., and all that. So do you pay attention to reviews? Is this all just a bunch of nonsense? I mean, how do you insulate yourself from, you know, these really kind of, and mostly women too, who tend to like go after you with pitchforks?
I read reviews. I read good and bad reviews, and ask that they be sent to me when they're in print. I think that, you know, people will always have valid criticisms and people will always have valid praise, and that doesn't just apply to me, but applies to every book. And you know, there's great books that other people love that I am not emotionally invested in. It all depends on whether there's something in the work that somebody latches onto emotionally. And that can't be a personal exchange between the writer and the reader.
Yeah.
You can't shoot one arrow and hit everybody at the same time. And that's just sort of the state of things, and that's fine.
Good art needs to polarize a few people?
I think so. Yeah. I think so, yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, I mean, there's also books that I didn't like as, you know, a young adult that I am starting to love now, and that I know that there'll be books that I, The Unbearable Lightness of Being is one of them.
Yeah.
I'll you know, I was like, I don't understand this. Why is this way? And then, you know, as an adult, I was like, oh, I get it. Actually, I really, really do like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's, and there's, I'm sure that there's books that I don't like now that I'm going to love in like 5 years, or books that I haven't tried reading hard enough, you know, past the first page, and that I'll. So I mean, we're all human, and we're all preoccupied with different things at different times, and different work speaks to us, and sometimes some work just doesn't speak to us at all, and that's valid. That's fine.
So you don't take a bad review terribly personally, or I mean, some writers say that they don't and they do, and I'm wondering if the whole review climate right now is even, is it more of a laugh than a genuine consideration, or do you take the takeaway from any reader seriously?
Well, I think that one of the things that you learn in a workshop is how to listen to the voices that apply to your vision. You know, you can't change who you are. What happens if you know, you write a book and all the reviews are good, but they're good because all these people saw in your book something that you didn't intend to write?
Yeah.
Well, hell, you know, like that's gonna, then what do? You're gonna change yourself as a writer to try to fit into the mold of the good reviews? You know, the same goes for bad reviews. If there's bad reviews, they hit on things that weren't necessarily a focus for you. They disagree with your vision. These are things that you can't, you know, at the end of the day, you write, you have to live with yourself, and you have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and say, what I wrote today, I'll stand by tomorrow, and you know, and that's the final draft that you put out. You know, I'm
yeah.
And so,
what do you mean you'll stand by tomorrow? I mean, enough time passes and then you'll start to sort of say, oh, I can't believe I wrote that. Has this happened to you yet?
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it happens on a daily basis. But at the same time, you have to, for me, I have to have had that moment where at one point about the work I said, this is the absolute best that I could do at this moment in my life as a writer. And whether I cringe tomorrow when I read it or 10 years from now when I read it, I made this piece with myself today. It may not be great. It may not last like 5 years. It may not last 5 minutes. It, you know, everybody might hate it or pan it, but this is really the best that I could do, and I can live with that, you know, whether I read it again or not. And I think that, you know, when you write, you have to have that moment, because otherwise, you know, yes, everybody's going to write a clunker. Everybody's going to write something that, you know, even your most ardent reviewer who loves you is going to say, what the hell were you thinking? And, you know, yes, it may have turned out to be a mistake, but at that moment, that's what you were thinking about, and you did the best you could. And
fail better, really.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you learn from it. And that's, you know, you can't, you have to plod on. And that's how it is, I think. You have to live with yourself.
And you're living with yourself quite fine.
I'm living with myself okay. I mean, like, I still, you know, there's, I'm extremely critical of myself as a writer. I have a tendency to erase pages and pages and pages and start over.
They don't even get printed out. They just get erased.
Yeah, they just get, like, just, you know, and people waiting for the writing, or, you know, my agent. what are you doing? And
what a great way to stave off the archivist.
Oh my god. No, but it is one of those things where it's like, well, I'm working on something. I think that it'll be ready. And then, you know, 2 weeks go by, 3 weeks go by, and it's like, is it ready yet? And you're like, oh, sorry, I erased it. It doesn't exist anymore. And I think that, in particular, writing from. There are dangers, there are pitfalls. I'm terrified of them. That overexposure thing is one, the idea of over-explaining things, of hitting the reader over the head, being too much in control of the writing in a bad, bad, bad way. That's one. Another is, you know, the idea that everything that comes off of my keyboard is gold, you know? Like, that's a terrifying notion. That's like complacency and entitlement, and those things terrify me, because I think it's easy to develop them, and not just for writers, but for anybody who's doing anything that that is personal to them, for all kinds of writers, for musicians, for dancers, for, you know, for everybody. And I think that once that starts to happen, you are in a long downward spiral.
But to be clear, we're talking actually in safe mode before the National Book Award, which you have been nominated for. And so I have no possible parallel experientially for this, but if you're concerned about everything that I write is going to turn to gold, and you have such pressure upon you, especially after The Orange and all that, then, you know, we've seen so many bright writers over the years who were perfectly fine, and they won awards, and they turned into complete assholes. So you know, you seem extremely level-headed, but, I mean, there is some level of corruption, perhaps, that becomes involved with these awards and the like. So what have you done to insulate yourself?
Well, I mean, there's a level of corruption, not like corruption like, you know, mob.
Yeah. I was trying to suggest you return to like Smeagol, no, the Gollum. I press you so I get the National Book Award.
Yeah. Awesome.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's great. That's great. I have a really distinct visual of this, like with my hair falling out.
You go up and you grab the award and you immediately... your flesh pullulates and encrusts.
Oh my God. No, but I think that everybody that I know, including J. Robert Lennon, every writer I know has said, you will never write a book the way you've written your first book again. Can't be done.
Yeah.
It just cannot be done. Don't live in that delusion anymore. For me, the most terrifying force is the presence of an audience and the idea of some sort of expectation about what the next one's going to look like. And you're not going to satisfy everybody. I mean, it's one of those things where it has to be a negotiation between yourself and this idea of, okay, I still have to write this the way I wrote the last one. I won't do it. It won't be ideal because I won't have, you know, this questioning of what if, you know, the bright dream. And even though it's still a bright dream, like, holy crap. You're doing something that you want and you love, and you get to spend hours doing it. Like, that is the dream.
Yeah.
You know, there's not this, idea. There's not a natural insulation of nobody's looking, nobody cares. You know, if you fall on your face, like, who's to know? And that's, you know, the idea that you can't reproduce that virginity is terrifying, but you still have to do it for the right reasons in the right way.
But to push the copulation metaphor further, there are many different ways to find pleasure in the activity.
That's true. How true. And now to push it even further. If only I could come up with something. No, but yes, there are. And there's new things to be learned as well
from
your original state.
There are lines to cross.
Exactly. Many taboos to break. But the thing is that you're still doing it for the same reason.
Yeah.
Pleasure. No. You're still doing it with this. Like, if nothing else is, if everything else has changed, at least the motivation is the same. And the motivation is, this is all I've ever wanted to do. I want to be a storyteller. I want to tell this story a particular kind of way. It may be different or the same as the last story I told, and hopefully I won't be an asshole at the end of it.
Yeah. Although that kind of I want to do this sounds very similar to like Sunset Boulevard.
Precious. Though.
That's, yes. Yeah. Or you know Norman Desmond or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's really interesting how you can have ambition, but it's also vital to have humility and vital to have realistic expectations about the books you produce after The Tiger's Wife.
I mean, at the end of the day, the most sobering thing about this, and the thing that, yes, it's extremely important to have humility. Here's why. A book is, you know, like the fact that a writer sits down, writes a novel, it's considered this elevated form of expression. It elevates the reader, you know, it's supposed to do all this, and it does. And it's true that, like, great books that you love and that I love, they change us as people. They put you in touch with something that you wanted to be in touch with but couldn't articulate. You never realized you felt all these things that they're you know, they're like those holds on a rock wall as you're climbing up. There's no going back after you read a book like that that really changes your life. It's still a book.
Yeah.
And the person who wrote it is just a storyteller. And at the end of the day, when you break all that down, you're an entertainer. You're not curing cancer. You're not doing something that is now going to make you oh so entitled. You know, like it's you're privileged as a writer to be able to do this thing that puts you in touch with something you believe in that maybe puts one or two hundred or one or 2,000 other people in touch with the same thing or something similar. That's ridiculous that exists. And in today's society where people with real jobs are losing their jobs,
yeah.
And you know, like people are starving in America and like all over the world, like you still get to do this, you know, and people maybe having a hard day, read your book and feel better or feel something. That's crazy that exists.
And that's enough to stave off the impulse. There was a recent piece that Richard Powers wrote where he says, I don't see what the point of, it's kind of ridiculous to think about writing fiction when there's so many global problems going on. And so do you have any similar thoughts along those lines, or does the idea of reaching those one to two, many more thousand people sort of stave that off, that kind of level of getting people psyched is at least some contribution towards, I guess, something better in a rather dystopic state, something similar to the sense of humor that you described earlier in the conversation.
I think that it is important. I think art has always, in the worst possible moments of the strife of civilizations, art pulls you through. And you remember the art, and people remember the art, and, oh, look what this particular moment in society produced, you know. Not just in literature, but in painting, in music, and, you know, these great things that continue to move us, and they moved us then, and they move us now. And I'm not saying that The Tiger's Wife by any means is that kind of work. But that is what, as a writer, you know, on your knees, you're really hoping for. And that's what great fiction does to me. And there is a place for it, because when you've had an absolutely horrible day, and or a horrible series of days or months or weeks, you still find something, some awe in art that moves you, whether it's fiction or music or painting or film. Something in that expression tells you something about yourself, and that connects you to your own humanity in a way that just the experience of strife doesn't.
Yeah.
And it is a time of strife. Like, the things that are going on right now are insane. And, but there's still a place for art, and there's still a place for writers. Brooklyn, no, like there's still a place for art and a place for writing and
just as there's a place for an Occupy movement, there is a place for a writer in every single one of those cities.
Yeah, exactly.
You're occupying in your own
yes,
way.
Yes, exactly. And
you're occupying bookshelves.
Yes. and it's you know, it's incredible to be a part of that, however little you contribute, you know, however, you know, when somebody comes up to me and says, I read it, I loved it, it helped me,
yeah.
You know, my first thought is like, how did it help? Like, that's amazing. Like, you know, it like,
yeah, why did you buy my book instead of go to a shrink?
Right. No, like, but like, I mean,
but then art does do that.
It does do that. And you know, there have been you know, I think that I, you know, a lot of people in college and grad years that have been in touch with me have been dealing with the death of a loved one, and it's the first time it's happened. And some of them, you know, have read the book, and they say that it was a helpful experience for them, that in reading it they somehow felt better. Like, what greater, how much more privileged can you feel as a writer, as a person, really, than that you know, somehow you helped somebody through something, however inadvertently, and that was your, you know. I'm sorry, there's a lot of hand waving going on here, and
no.
I'm making a lot of faces.
I think that image of hand waving and face making is a good one to end this conversation. But Taya, it was an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. One more time.